Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. It's okay, you know, to be a little confused about who's doing what to whom in all the trade news we've had of late. We will take some time today and sort it all out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday is upon us. This one's the 18th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. With a nod to everything else that has been happening in the news of late, today and all the other days, there is a whole bunch of stuff that I kind of feel like we need to catch you up on. Some trade stuff, some market stuff, just a bunch. So for however minutes of live radio it takes, which is going to be five, spoiler alert, Lee Gallagher's at Fortune Magazine, Dion Rabowan is at Yahoo Finance. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai. Okay.
Yeah, they only let me go five. Hey, Lee, so I want to I want to talk a little trade here to get things going.
And sure.
Man, there's so much. But the first thing I want to talk about is something we dug into yesterday. This idea that things are now happening in response to Trump administration policy actions, right? The things that he has done that were probably foreseeable. The European Union and the Japanese perhaps taking us to the World Trade Organization over the steel and aluminum tariffs. China buying Russian soybeans instead of American soybeans. China stopping accepting American scrap, recyclable scrap, which we talked about a week or two ago. Did nobody think of this, or did they think of this and say, yeah, we'll take the risk?
That's a really that's the million-dollar question, and that question applies to so many things with this administration, which sometimes seems to think only about today, not about yesterday, not about tomorrow. But, you know, the Fed board was concerned about this in their minutes that came out a month ago, and it was not so much the impact of on the agrarian sector, which is an important and just the overall economic outlook, but the concern over retaliatory actions. It's so expected. It's so logical. And here we are. And it's significant.
Dion, let me ask you to spin it forward to the NAFTA deal, which Paul Ryan said a couple of three, 4 days ago, look, 17th is a deadline. We got to have everything by the 17th. And oh, my goodness, that was yesterday. And NAFTA is still not done.
Yeah, well, apparently there was some wiggle room, which is what Representative Ryan said today. But I actually think that maybe he had it right when he listed Thursday as a possible deadline, because not only does this have to get approved by the negotiators who are going out there working for President Trump's team, the Mexican negotiators as well as the Canadians, but then the U.S. Congress has to ratify it. Before that happens, it's got to be ratified by the U.S. International Trade Commission. So there's a number of different bodies that have to approve this. And you also have not just U.S. midterms coming up in November. You've got the Mexican presidential election where Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO, is leading the polls. He is expected to take a much harder line stance against President Trump than current Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto has. And that could really put NAFTA in jeopardy, even if the current negotiators do come up with a deal. So we are right now between what seems like a rock and a hard place when it comes to NAFTA.
Well, so, you know, it's interestingly, I wasn't going to actually bring this up, but Dion mentioning the elections brings me to this point. There will come a moment in the American political calendar, as it were, where everything stops because of these elections. And I'm wondering when the trade news out of the White House gets subsumed and it just slows to a grinding halt?
That's a good question. I mean, another question that's sort of related is, you know, how do voters respond? You know, if there's serious concern over the economic impact of this trade war, you know, even if it dissipates, at a certain point that becomes fixed in the voters' minds.
Right.
And there's a delayed reaction in terms of changing that sentiment. So, you know, I think that you know, you're right, that this is going to become, you know, pushed to the side at some point. But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I think for the next, you know, at least few weeks or several months or few months, I think this is going to be top on investors' mind, top on CEOs' minds, top on everyone's mind.
Huh. Dion, with that actually, as a little cue, Lee talking about investors' minds, I wanted to touch base with you on the bond market, and specifically the 10-year Treasury note, which has been going up for the past, you know, couple of weeks-ish on a reasonably steady basis, and now is at plus or minus 3%, which is historically still low, but it's getting higher. People are getting edgy about it, and I want you to tell me why or why not people should worry about that.
People should worry about it, but also they shouldn't worry about it. I'm going to do the old economist.
Can you do both? I don't know if you can do that.
I'm going to do the old economist on the one hand and on the other hand. As you pointed out, these rates are still historically low, but we have punched through that psychological barrier, which was 3%, mm-hmm. and an actual important technical level, which was right about 3.05%, and we're now above that, or we reached above that at 3.1%.
Yeah.
So inflation expectations for the market have really started to take on a meaningful rise, and there seems to be a lot of momentum. And as we know with Wall Street, once there's momentum in one direction, it's really hard to stop it. And so as rates get higher, that means interest rates on things like mortgages, car loans, all sorts of other things are going to start to rise. And that could really pour some cold water on the economy.
But this is also related to tariffs. I mean, tariff fallout is considered to be something that hurts growth and feeds inflation. So I think we're seeing that reflected in those moves.
No, that's totally right. That's right. And that's full circle to what the Fed was talking about in the minutes you referred to 4 minutes and 45 seconds ago, which is...
We went full circle.
There we go. Under five.
Full circle. Lee Gallagher of Fortune Magazine, Dion Rabowan at Yahoo Finance. Thanks, you too.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, traders, well, they kind of phoned it in on this Friday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A little bit more on trade now, which, by way of reminder, has two main parts. The steel and aluminum tariffs, which are being applied and have gone into effect with various exemptions, it should be said, on everybody on the planet. And then the separate set of tariff back and forth that the United States is having with China. And on that part, there is some confusion. American negotiators had told CNN that China has offered to cut its trade surplus, that is, our trade deficit with Beijing, on which the president continues to be focused, by $200 billion. The Chinese say that's not true. But whichever is the case, there are some problems with that idea. How many problems? Here's Marketplace's Sabri Benishour.
The president basically wants China to buy more than twice as much stuff from the U.S. as it does right now.
There's the problem that it's simply impossible.
Eric Altbach is with the Albright Stonebridge Group. He's also a former deputy assistant U.S. trade representative. The U.S. economy is at full capacity. There's not really any room to just whip up $200 billion worth of more production.
So the single biggest product we export is $16 billion worth of aircraft and parts. And, you know, in order to dramatically increase that, Boeing, for example, would have to stop meeting its obligations to other customers in other markets.
Now, increasing U.S. exports over time, in general, would not be a bad thing, says Brad Setzer with the Council on Foreign Relations.
But I don't think you're going to get there with flashy commitments to buy more soybeans.
The Albright Stonebridge Group's Eric Altbeck goes further.
When you look at the sort of obsession with zeroing out bilateral trade deficits with all of our trading partners, it's sort of economically irrational.
Irrational for a lot of reasons, primarily that it completely misses the biggest problem plaguing the U.S.-China trade relationship.
The real issue is the openness of the Chinese economy, the fact that American corporations do not have access to markets in China.
Robert Daly is director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center. He says Chinese law forces U.S. companies there to share their technology, and Chinese companies outright steal it. Additionally, the Chinese government subsidizes or controls many Chinese firms.
Making an adjustment to the trade deficit doesn't come close to approaching these issues.
Addressing the real issues, he says, would require changes in China's overall approach to its economy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Speaking of those steel and aluminum tariffs, as I was, and exemption requests there too, the Commerce Department now says it's gotten 12,000 corporate exemption requests. They've added 13 people to handle all the paperwork, and we have been watching the database of applications at regulations.gov grow for about a month now. One of the first people we talked to was Sam Desai. He imports stainless steel for use in appliances, washing machines, for instance, and we checked back in with him today.
every day, it's all about the tariffs now.
As in?
Actually, right now, the situation is that the U.S. prices have picked up a lot.
Basically, everybody's getting used to paying more, and he, Sam, is just glad he got his application in early.
I did it in April, and then I think they finally put it on end of April. And then, you know, I'm glad I put it in because there's so many more after that.
Tim Poole works for the Gemini Group. They make a whole bunch of metal and plastic products, aluminum extrusion dies among them, out of Muscle Shoals, Alabama. They've actually been off the hook for steel that they import from Sweden and Brazil because those two countries got temporary exemptions from the White House.
We're hoping that they could just get resolved and say, well, we'll do these concessions if you'll remove the tariffs, and everybody goes home happy.
Didn't quite work out that way, so he submitted a formal exemption request a couple of weeks ago, just got posted today. It was not easy getting it done, though.
At first, it was just trying to determine how to fill out the applications.
Poole says he even had to take a couple of legal seminars to figure out how to do the paperwork. It took time, but he is actually in favor of the tariffs.
We feel like if that's the way it's going to go, then we can deal with it, and we can, and in fact, that would encourage us to find domestic suppliers, in which that's one of the processes we're doing right now. We're hunting or trying to define what domestic suppliers could help take care of our needs.
And Tim Poole says he is betting his customers are going to understand that they're going to have to pay more. There was a White House conference on prison reform today, as part of which the President's Council of Economic Advisers released a report on prison rehabilitation programs, one finding of which was that recidivism is expensive. The CEA says some programs work really well to solve people who have committed crimes going back to jail, specifically mental health and substance abuse programs. The report said every dollar spent that way can save more than five taxpayer dollars in the future. Numbers that Market Police's Jed Kim reports don't quite add up.
There are a lot of prison rehabilitation programs, but which work? The Council of Economic Advisers report says for every dollar invested into substance abuse and mental health treatment, taxpayers will later save anywhere from a buck and a half to five and a quarter. How they got to those numbers, however, is a bit of a mystery. Jennifer Doliak teaches public policy at the University of Virginia. Her work was cited by the council as helping inform the report.
Substance abuse treatment and mental health treatment are very promising and a good place for governments to start, you know, experimenting more and investing more and evaluating what works. But in general, the evidence is just super thin.
She says so much more research needs to be done and that there's a danger if the CEA's figures aren't taken with the appropriate grain of salt.
Most practitioners and government leaders think we know exactly what we need to do. We just need more resources. And the reality is we have no idea what to do.
The CEA's calculations sound similar to economic benefits that some have found in prisoner education programs. Lois Davis researches the topic for the RAND Corporation.
The conservative estimate is that type of savings of for every dollar spent on education programs, you're saving about $5 in incarceration costs. So that's been pretty widely demonstrated and accepted.
Davis wonders why her research doesn't seem to have been part of the council's arithmetic. The report states there's less consistent evidence of the benefits of educational programs. Nikhil Singh is the faculty director of the NYU Prison Education Program, which includes about 50 inmates.
The program has really created a great atmosphere and even changed the environment within the prison.
He says the program doesn't have enough seats to meet demand. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up,
they will be apologizing for this same thing 6 months or a year from now, and they all know it.
Yeah, but then what happens? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials barely budged today, added just a single point, 24,715. The NASDAQ down 0.3%, 28 points, 73.54. The S&P 500 clipped off 0.2%, 7 points, 27.12. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow slid 0.4%. The NASDAQ shed 0.6%. The S&P 500 slipped about 0.5%. The uncertainty around trade et al. Took a toll on bank stocks. J.P. Morgan Chase withdrew more than 1.5%. Today, Citigroup erased more than 2%. On the upside, Deere & Company, the heavy equipment manufacturer, packed on more than 5%. Shares in Boeing rose more than 2%. Macy's boxed up 0.3% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note actually fell 3.05%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, it's Kai. You hear me say it all the time. Watch the bond market if you want to understand the economy. Well, you should also watch our YouTube channel for quick video explainers, things you've always wondered about, stories beyond the headlines. Subscribe on YouTube or at Marketplace APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. You don't get more iconic a company in this economy than Campbell's Soup. I mean, the can is literally an icon. So much so, in fact, that Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross used it on CNBC a couple of months ago to try to dispel the notion that those steel and aluminum tariffs were going to have much of an effect.
In the can of Campbell's Soup, there's about 2.6 pennies worth of steel. So if that goes up by 25%, that's about 0.6 cents on the price of a can of Campbell's Soup. Well, I just bought this can today at a 7-Eleven down here, and the price was $1.99. So who in the world is going to be too bothered by 0.6 cents?
So, about that. Campbell reported quarterly profits this morning, and they were terrible and likely to get worse. To quote the company's chief financial officer, "We expect double-digit increases on steel and aluminum, and all of it's driven by the impact of anticipated tariffs," end of quote. Bad as that was and is for Campbell, it took second billing to the news that CEO Denise Morrison is going to retire, as in today, after 7 years in which she tried to but couldn't turn the company away from canned and packaged toward consumers' fresh food tastes. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports, no matter the company, that is a tough, tough ask.
Here's the thing about processed foods. People still love them, like me and my frozen mac and cheese. David Van Amberg with the American Customer Satisfaction Index says there are consumers out there that continue to give these foods high ratings.
Honestly, we're looking at numbers today that are very, very similar, within a point of the numbers that we were seeing, say, 15, 20 years ago.
But Van Amberg says even with these fans, overall, there are fewer people buying processed foods. A Credit Suisse report found that the top 20 U.S. food and beverage companies lost $18 billion in market share between 2011 and 2017. To combat shrinking sales, these food companies are appealing to our healthier tastes.
They call it cleaning the label.
Darren Seifer is with the consumer research firm NPD Group.
If they're going to use a preservative, that it's a natural preservative, or they just don't use preservatives at all.
Ditching artificial colors and using fewer chemicals is one step, but Michael Halen with Bloomberg Intelligence says in some cases, companies like ConAgra, which makes banquet frozen dinners, must shift their identities. For example, downplaying Salisbury steak in favor of buffalo chicken.
They're just modernizing. They're giving people what they want is really all they're doing.
Halen says some companies are doing a better job of figuring out what more health-conscious consumers want, while others remain tied to the past. And those companies, he says, are paying for it. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
There's a thing happening now in some parts of corporate America that's worth a mention here. It's not quite an apology tour, but some big companies, Facebook, Uber, and Wells Fargo most prominently, have started running ad campaigns basically saying, we're sorry for various and sundry scandals the past couple of weeks or months. Is it going to work? Marketplace's Renata Sago digs in.
Facebook, Uber, and Wells Fargo have carefully crafted TV ads to say to millions of users and consumers, hey, we know we messed up. From Facebook's emotional appeal.
Facebook will do more to keep you safe and protect your privacy.
Because earning back your trust is our greatest priority.
Uber's new CEO promises a better road ahead, and Wells Fargo's ad pledges a new day of trust. What's missing from these apologies, according to crisis management expert Eric Bernstein, are clear answers. He says the apology bar is high for companies that have violated the trust of their users and consumers.
They want to know what happened. They want to know what you did to fix it and how you're going to prevent it from happening again.
Determining whether a company has learned from its mistakes will take time, says Roy Lewicki, who teaches business at Ohio State University. For him, the test will be how companies follow through on promised changes.
The real proof will be, are there really different things going on? And only the users of those services are going to know the difference.
But for Ross Martin, who runs the brand strategy firm Blackbird, these latest apology ads are part of what he calls the sorry cycle. Companies want to hold on to their users and consumers as they put new practices into place.
They will be apologizing for this same thing or something like it 6 months or a year from now, and they all know it.
Take Wells Fargo, which yesterday acknowledged its employees had been altering documents about corporate clients. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Love can be hard. Finding love can be even harder, especially if you're a man of marriageable age in China, where experts are figuring there are going to be 30 million more eligible men than women over the next 30 years. That's in part because of China's decades-long one-child policy, as you know, but it's also a full-blown business opportunity for the growing number of entrepreneurs there who make money helping those single men find love. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack has the story from Shanghai.
Every week, dating coach Cheng Zhen uploads a video advising China's lonely men. In this clip, he's meeting a mechanical engineer, Qi Dongwei, who recalls having an excruciating crush back in college.
I never attempted to hold her hand, even after chasing her for 2 years.
Qi Dongwei hasn't had much luck with women since, and the pressure is on. The country's lopsided demographics means nearly 1 in 20 men in China are likely to remain unmarried. Qi Dongwei is determined not to be one of them. He's among the 5 million people who have turned to the videos from what Cheng Zhen calls his school of love. They address topics like why men in China fear that to get a date, they have to be rich.
When American couples go out on dates, they usually split the bill, but in China, the man usually pays for everything.
He says growing up, he himself worried about finding a girlfriend. His family wasn't wealthy, and he was a short, skinny kid with glasses.
My mother would tell me to eat eggs and drink milk. She said I already had an ugly face, so if I didn't grow taller, I wouldn't be able to find a wife.
At 18, Cheng Zhen was still single. So while he was in the U.S. for college, he pored over books on psychology and went to bars to observe how men approached women, until he perfected his technique. He's been teaching his methods for the past decade, and switching to fluent English, he explains how he might approach me.
Hey, Jennifer, the way you ask questions and stuff, you know, really intrigued me. I don't know why you just hobby is so insightful. I want to know more about you.
Then he says he might invite me for a coffee.
That's the normal process. But at this time, I'm not saying, oh my God, Jennifer, you know, you're the love of my life. I love you. Right, you'll be like freaked out. A lot of Chinese men, a lot of my clients are doing that.
Such over-eagerness, he says, arises partly because young people in China tend to start dating much later than their American counterparts. They're expected to focus on their studies, then pressured to marry after college. So there's a growing market for so-called professional pickup artists, a label commonly given in China to those helping men find relationships. Their courses can cost thousands of dollars. In his slick videos, Cheng Zhen gives free advice as a hook to drive business to his e-book and audio lessons, which cost between $8 and $90. Tips include wash your hair before a date and advice on whether spending more money on a woman shows that you love her more. His answer is no. Eric Kung was so impressed with Cheng Zheng's dating advice that he caught the bullet train to Shanghai just to meet with him.
After our talk, I realized that I'm not a loser just because I can't handle everything for a woman. That's other people's expectations.
And Cheng Zheng says there are plenty of men like Eric Kung out there, and he hopes his counseling can lead them to their own self-discoveries, and maybe even a date. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I want you to close your eyes, assuming it's safe, of course, clear your mind, and think about some of the defining smells of your childhood. Everybody's going to have different ones, I get that, but I do think there are going to be a couple of commonalities, including Play-Doh. From Gizmodo today, this item, Hasbro has finally trademarked the smell of it. It's technically a sensory mark, defined now and forever in the records of the United States Patent and Trademark Office as a sweet, slightly musky vanilla fragrance with slight overtones of cherry combined with the smell of a salted wheat-based dough. Which is, yeah, about how I remembered it. It tastes the same way, too. Come on, you ate Play-Doh too, right? Don't tell me you didn't. All right, we're leaving. Dow Industrial is basically flat today, added just a point. NASDAQ down 0.3%, 28 points. S&P 500 clipped off 0.2%. That is 7 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.